Okay, let's start. Today's topics are the experiment, the lab experiment, which I'm going to use here as some kind of an example. There will be a lot of theory here, but I'll try in the end here to do this a little bit more practical by showing you an example of data analysis. There are some activities here. I'm not sure how this works. The idea behind the experiment that we do is to that there is always the true score that we have is always has always some errors connected to it. What we observe is partly the true values of something we want to investigate, and partly also some kind of an error measurement. And what we try to do here, what we aim for, is to try to control this error in some way. We can measure it, or we can try to eliminate it completely. When you read about experimental designs, you will see that a lot of different names are used on that, and the list of experimental designs is more or less endless. This is by no means a complete list. It's just examples of names of different experimental designs that in different ways tries to control different factors that may contribute to understanding the outcome of a study. The examples that I'm giving now has a lot to do with, let's say, controlled experiments that we do in more or less a lab setting, where we try to control things in that way. A lot of the studies we do are, of course, outside this laboratory setting. It has a lot to do with, it could be what we call post de facto designs, where we try to investigate something that exists out there already. One of the articles that you were analyzing in the first essay, the Kansas article, was a typical example of a what we call a post de facto design, where you were investigating something that existed out there. A lot of historical research, for instance, where you want to see the effect of something, is also in that category, where you actually can't control things in the same way, but you still apply some of the same techniques to existing phenomena as well. Well, the aim here is to take control. And the classical example of such an experimental design is what we call the pre-test, post-test design, where we try to measure something first. We observe something, and then we do something, and measure what has happened afterwards. This is the classic experimental design. In its cleanest form, or in its first form, where you have only one group, well, there's a lot of things you actually can't control for. You can't be sure that the change from the first observation to the second observation was due to the intervention you had. Maybe something else has happened, as we have talked about before. Maybe time itself is enough. So we actually don't have that much control in such a setting. When you try out medicines, for instance, if introducing the medicine here actually helped the situation, well, it can be that time itself was the cure. We don't know. It's usually a good idea to use some kind of a more controlled setting, and one of the ways to do that is to introduce a control group. So that is what's being done in this control group design, where we, in addition to the experimental group that gets treatment, have a control group that does not get the treatment. And in a medical experiment, the non-treatment thing would be as similar to the treatment situation as possible, meaning that you also give some kind of a presumed neutral treatment to the control group. So the groups are similar, but it's only the what you plan to or what you want to investigate whether it has an effect or not. That is introduced in the experimental group. So in if we use the example from medical experimentation, well, in this control group, you would get a similar pill as you would get in the treatment group here, but not consisting the medicine. That's what we call a placebo treatment. So then we can control that. If you have a change only in the experimental group, well, then you can be pretty sure that the change was due to you introducing the medicine you wanted to test out here. You will sometimes see the notion quasi-experimental designs used here and there. We say that something is a true experimental design if group assignment, whether you are part of a control group or an experimental group, is randomized. So any individual in the population should have the same chance of coming into the experimental group as coming into the control group. That's what we define as the difference between a true experimental design and a quasi-experimental design. But there are a lot of other things that may happen. The experiment that the design that I mentioned here is just one example. It's not at all very commonly used, but it shows the what we can control for in different experimental designs. This is called the Solomon 4-group design, where you have 4 groups and where you can control for a number of other factors as well, in addition to whether the treatment works or not. The R here in this notion means that there is a randomization when it comes to what group you are part of. What this experiment controls for is, for instance, well, in its simplest form, it's just the same as you did in a normal, control group design. So the first groups are similar to that. But for the second, the next two groups, you do something else. Well, for instance, you don't do the pre-measurement, because there is a potential that measuring something again, measuring the same phenomena 2 times, in itself has some effect. It can be putting the focus on something so that the participants consciously or unconsciously change his behavior. And by having a group that only gets the treatment here, or only get the changes that we want to introduce, and not measuring them first, well, then we can also get an idea of the effect of the measurement itself. So this is just an example of a more complicated design among many other types of design. A very commonly used design is what we call a factorial design, where you can have, for instance, two groups and two conditions, creating a 4x4 table. Let's say that group one first gets... you have two groups, and these two groups can... Let's say you have two conditions. Will you let the first group have the first condition first, and the second group gets then the condition? Well, let me try an example here. It's difficult to explain. One of the groups here had an example, or are going to do something like this in their project here. I'm going to use an example from you now. They're going to investigate the effect of having a full bladder on... Am I ruining this the group selection here now? No? Okay, they want to check the effect of how full your bladder is, how that affects problem solving and how good problem solver you are. So they are then using two groups here. One group does the test first with a full bladder, then with an empty bladder. The other groups do it the other way around. They do the test first with an empty bladder and then with a full bladder. And then we can see whether there is an effect of the test itself, for instance. So by splitting things into subgroups like this, it can be very complicated if you have more than two conditions. You have something called Latin square, which is an even more complicated form of this experiment or this experimental design. But these are all designs that have this. They want to apply different techniques to control for potential disturbing factors in the experiment. In this case, it can be that participants become much better problem solvers the next time they try to solve the problem, for instance. And by having such a design, we can control for factors like this. So just one example. But experimental designs doesn't necessarily involve groups. Well, it can create groups eventually, but there are also very strong designs that instead of measuring groups under two conditions, try to measure something a number of times. So by creating this type of time series, having a lot of observations, creating a very stable baseline, you eliminate a lot of the variation between tests, for instance. And then you can say that when you introduce something, well, how does this line change? Does it rapidly increase in its growth or something like that? Because it may be a phenomenon that has a steady increase over time. But maybe this increase changes when you introduce something. And this again is a very strong design when it comes to coping with large variation between individuals. So that's also a phenomenon you want to try to control for in experiments. And of course you can have this in groups as well. So you can apply time series analysis or these types of strategies also for group designs. But it's a bit more time consuming. So there are arguments for that and against it. Okay, this was just an example of experimental methods. Few of you will actually apply such methods in your master thesis. You will probably do, a lot of you will do types of data analysis, but typically not on in this type of controlled setting where you have controlled groups and very structured observations, more in a lab setting. But again, you will still want to use similar, let's say, similar techniques as we have here. I'll just try to start something here now. Let's see if this one works. No. It's not the one I wanted. I think I'll just let this one run for a little while. Before we move into hypothesis testing, I'll just repeat some of this now, because what we want to do now is to we wanted to see whether the reason for using statistics is to see whether something we observe actually is true, and to what extent is it true. And as I said earlier, in order to do that, we do what we call hypothesis testing, where we test two different hypotheses against each other, where we test the chance that a scientific hypothesis is overwhelmingly true compared to the null hypothesis. So these are the terms we use. And as I have said earlier, this is some kind of a structured decision-making process where we what we investigate is whether we are dealing with, and this is a bit complicated, dealing with one population or two populations. The example that I try to show here, if I can put that up on this application as well. Just try to do this. Wow, that's nice. It's probably better here. Any phenomena that we try to observe has some variability, or almost any phenomena that we observe has some kind of variability. There are usually not very there is usually a huge overlap between groups, and this is just a demonstration of such phenomena. This is, you could say, the green balls here and the red balls. They represent different values of some kind of a phenomena, or two different groups that actually are slightly different. The red balls are dropped up here, so their mean value is around this area, while the green balls have their mean value a bit lower. But as you can see here, when a phenomena has variability, these are just gates where it can drop either left or right a number of times, and any phenomena that has this this type of chance to it will eventually end up in something we refer to as a normal distribution. So the phenomena will vary, and but the interesting thing here is, of course, that most of these observations are overlapping, so they are somewhere in the middle here. You can end up with situations where some of the most extremes actually are the highest scoring groups. The lowest score may come from the group that is highest here. So let's just say, assume that this is a test that measures gender differences in some kind of problem solving, where females are slightly better than males. You may end up with the best male scoring in this category up here. And what we want to do when we do statistical testing is, at least when it comes to what we call refer to as inferential statistics, is to check out whether our findings actually suggest that there are two populations here and not only one population when a phenomena have a typical distribution like this, when you have an overlap like this. In this case, that's the case. And by applying statistical tests, we could also find this, and we can read this from our statistical package. So distributions aren't perfect. They are can be skewed up one way. Distributions may be different in two different groups. And that is what we want to compare. Let's go back to the stuff here. Okay. That's not where I was. And of course, just to repeat this, you may end up here doing mistakes. And the most serious mistake to do is what we call this type 1 error, where you, even though the populations actually were similar, you say that there were a difference between the two groups. And that's the reason for applying very strict and conservative rules for rejecting the null hypothesis. And that's what we do here. We try to reject the null hypothesis and keep the experimental hypothesis. That's what we do in hypothesis testing. And type 1 error, as I mentioned, is to falsely reject the null hypothesis, while the type 2 error, the beta error, is the where you actually fail to reject an erroneous null hypothesis. But still, that's an error we are more, it's usually not as bad as the first one. So and we can actually control for this by applying different what we call significance levels, and I'll show you that later. A very normal way to start data analysis is first to, because in a lot of statistics we assume that data are in some way normally distributed or have a certain distribution. So that's usually a good way to start things. Describe the data. For instance, you want to look at differences between mean scores and median scores. There are two reasons for that. One reason is that you want to pick out extreme scores, outliers that may be due to could be punching errors or scoring errors or something like that. If most scores are in the range 0 to 1 and you have the value 50 there, well, it's probably 0.5 and not 50, and you can you can take out that score. That's something you will you can see if you check the difference from between means and medians. In some cases, it's also interesting to check for the modal value, the occurring value in a data set, because that may be different for two groups. Even though the variability is large, well, this can give you some additional information. So, looking at the data first, we often refer to this as some kind of data hygiene, where we try to clean out the data a little bit. Well, that's the usual starting point. And what we also find out where we do this is how the data are distributed. Are they actually in a normal distribution? And how do they deviate from that? Because that may give important information about group differences. And as I said, any phenomena that we observe that has this type of variability between individuals, for instance, or even within when you score things many times for one person, well, we will vary a little bit. So any phenomena tends to have this bell-shaped form where you have a mean value in the middle, but where values are distributed out. Our height, our shoe size, our the length of the fingers, for that sake, when you plot enough people, you will get a distribution like this. And a distribution like this has some properties connected to it, defined by what we call the standard deviation, which is a measurement of how, you could say, how high or how wide the distribution is. Between, you could say, a plus minus one standard deviation, you will find approximately 68% of your scores in a normal distribution. If you take two standard deviations out, if you go two standard deviations out, you will cover 96% of your population. So having scores outside that is not so usual. Well, what are the scores? How do we define what defines a standard deviation? Well, let's just use an example from my area where we have measures, for instance, of intelligence. Intelligence is a phenomenon that has this type of normal variation connected to it, and that's also a standardized measurement where we have defined certain properties to that. We have said that a certain score on an intelligence test, the mean score for a part of the population, in an age group, for instance, is defined as 100 points. So that's what we say is the mean score. And based on the normal distribution, every 15 points, or the standard deviation of intelligence, is defined as 15 points. So within the range of 100 plus minus 15, meaning 85 to 115, we will find 68% of the population. If we extend this and add 15 points, giving us what? 70 to 130, you will cover 96% of the population. So only 2% is expected to have a higher IQ score than 130. So I guess those are criteria that Mensa, for instance, uses to take members. I think the score of 130 or something like that, or maybe 135 or something, is used as the score there, or as the limit there. So this is just an example of such a phenomena that has this type of variability. I'll just do a little jumping here. One way of expressing such variability that's very common, because you want to show your readers when you write or communicate science, these types of distributions is something you want to communicate to your public. You want to say something about the uncertainties or the span of some kind of observation, and that's of course based on your findings, your standard deviation, how wide that is compared to the actual differences between groups, for instance. So One way of expressing this, which is quite common, is to show what we call confidence intervals. And that's an estimated range of the true value of the phenomena that you are measuring, based on the uncertainties that you have. You try to estimate to the whole population the true value from your limited set of observations. This is just one example of that, which is maybe a bit too clean, and much cleaner than you will see in real life usually, where we were measuring the length of what's called saccades, the very rapid movement of ice between fixations, where we use an eye tracker, and had three different conditions. Where over these three conditions, well, we had different mean scores for the length of these saccades. So it of course this seems pretty clear, but there are a lot of uncertainties connected to such observations. And that's what we estimate here. So the confidence interval of 95%, for instance, tells us something about, gives us an estimation of where we believe the true value of the score is. And in this case, it should be somewhere between here. It's most likely somewhere in the middle, because this is also normally distributed. But what we can see here is that at least these two groups, the mid group here, overlaps quite a lot with both the extreme groups. Meaning that we actually can't be very sure about the difference between these groups. What seems to be quite clear is that these two groups are very different, because the confidence intervals aren't overlapping at all here. So this gives us some additional descriptive information about the population or the observations we have made compared to, let's say, the hypothesis testing itself. So we can read a lot out of descriptive analysis of data alone. There are different types of, I'll just go very briefly through some types of statistical measurements we can do, also in hypothesis testing now. But I will, after a short break, I will try to show you this on a data set, where we actually do some of this stuff on a real data set. As I said, we mentioned earlier that data could be put in different categories. It could be there could be nominal, only names, like gender, like study program, like stuff like that, where you work, for instance. So you can't actually rank them in any way. Or they could be in the other end, ratio or scale dates, where you have a huge variability of scores from, 0 to 100, for instance, or your height in centimeters or something like that. But also on very simple data, you can do some types of hypothesis testing. You can test whether you have strange deviations from a random occurrence of some kind of a phenomena. In this case, you had you want to check whether there is a connection between hormone treatment and the occurrence of cancers. It's of course extremely simplified. The point here is that of these 55 persons that took part in this experiment or the post-facto descriptions, 30 were exposed to the hormones that we were interested in, while 25 were not. And if these, if the occurrence of cancers were unrelated to this, well, you should have the same distribution here. You should have 12. Well, you can't have 12 and a half, probably, but you should have 12 and 13 here. If there was a random distribution when it comes to whether you have this cancer form or not. This should be similar for the two conditions. So you should have 15, 15 here. When you have a deviation from that, when the group that was exposed to this hormone have a large, overwhelming chance of getting something compared to the group that weren't, which is in the no group. Well, you can test this statistically. You can perform something called a chi-square test, where you test the deviation from a random distribution in a table like this, typically a 4x4, 2x2 table, but it can be more complex tables as well. So it can be a 4x4 table or a 4x2 table or something like that. But it's data that's categorical and put into categories like this. So you can do this type of testing even if you don't have scale type of data. When you do this type of tests, well, there are a number of conditions that must be there to allow you to do that type of statistical testing. In this case, when it comes to this chi-square test, you assume that data is from a random sample. For instance, you need to make sure that the groups are large enough. There should be more than 5 observations in each cell in your table, for instance. So there are a number of these things that that are applied, or that you assume, or that puts limitations to using a certain type of statistics. This is not... I don't expect you to remember all these limitations and the different tests in detail, but this is just to give you some idea about what we do when we do statistical testing, and I will show you this in this statistical package that I'm using afterwards. So you can say the other type of the other big type of hypothesis testing we do is what we call inferential statistics, where we test our distributions, where we do estimations of the whole population based on the observations we have made. And then we so when we have a limited number of observations, well, we estimate how the population would look like based on this sample. And that's what we do when we compare groups. A very commonly used such test is what we call the independent samples t-test, or also referred to as students t-test. And that's a situation where we have typically two groups. Well, that's one of the the t-test is a an analysis of variance where we actually have two groups. So one of the one of the variables, usually the independent variable, have two levels. It could be gender, it could be a yes or no situation, it could be treatment, no treatment, for instance. And then we look at the means and the variability of scores in two groups. So in this ball dropping experiment, we would test whether the groups, based on the number of observations we have, we would estimate the standard deviation, the mean score, and then check whether this, what is the chance of this phenomena occurring just by chance, that these two groups should be there just by chance. Are they one population or are they two populations? We will. I will show you some of this later, and also point to what we then call significance levels in this connection. I think we'll take the break now, and then I will prepare the actual data analysis, which is based on a data set that was an exam set at the University of Bergen this year, where we check, this is somewhat neutral ground because none of us are involved in this, and it's data that's not very, could say, familiar to any of us. It has to do with nurses going night shifts and how that affects their life. So that's what we're going to do after the break. So let's meet in 15 minutes. Yeah. I can overrule it. Okay, it's very difficult to talk about this in theory only, but just to try to explain it in another way. Usually when we do some kind of testing, when we measure some phenomena, we don't have an unlimited number of observations, because if we had enough observations, it would be pretty obvious that these two populations were different. But if you have a limited number of observations like we have here, well, then we are using inferential statistics to estimate the real distributions of these of the phenomena that we are measuring. So we want to see, based on a limited number of observations, whether these observations are actually two populations or only one population. Just random examples from one population. And of course, based on very few observations, it's kind of difficult to do this. So we apply statistical techniques. Hopefully this will become somewhat easier to understand now when we show this more in practice. So what I have here now is somewhat nursed, that's maybe a double thing, nursed data set of nurses night shifts, whether they go night shifts or not, and their sleep habits, their levels of anxiety, depression, whether that's related to having a lot of night shifts. That's what they wanted to investigate in this data set. So it's a questionnaire, a rather relatively complex questionnaire that's sent out, where we have a number of subscales in addition to the measurements of how many night shifts, etc., you have been to. If we now look at the data set, let's see if I can find that. And share this application. A data set could look somewhat like this, and this is the real data set from this study. Where and this is how you also in the trial experiment that you're going to do is going to organize data. Data are organized where so that one line represents one case, in this case one person that has answered to the questionnaire, and every column here is then one variable. So gender is one variable, how many night shifts did you do last year is the next one, do you have children at home is the next question. So these are typically independent variables then, and we want to see whether that has any effect on the number of health variables that we measure. The first variables here, the first, let's say, I think eight questions, is a scale that measure daytime sleepiness, called ESS. The next few questions are questions that measure So there are another, I think, 6 questions that measure insomnia, problems of sleeping during nighttime. Then we have some kind of a personality measure of how much of an A person you are. Are you typically a guy that's goes to sleep early and wakes early? That's the A type person here. Or is it the other way around? So a high score there means you're more of an A-type person. And then finally, we have a subscale that's called Hospital Anxiety and Depression Scale, which are measurements, a number of questions that where we can take out separate measures of anxiety and depression. Finally, we ask a few questions in this questionnaire. We could also look at this as variables. We ask a few questions on these 3 questions are questions of about alcohol consumption. And we have also a few questions in the end here on how much coffee do you drink and how much... do you smoke or not? So these are then measured as potential confounding factors that may affect the result more than maybe the number of nights, night shifts you go or something like that. So what we start to do when we have data like this is to make, you could say, scales out of the subsets of questions. So in a data package like this, I could then, for instance, make a subscale that's called ESS, which is this daytime sleepiness scale. And I make that just by summarizing the scores here. So a higher score in the end here will give me a higher score on this variable. And I can do this quite easily in a package like this by saying that I want to compute a new variable. And that new variable is, well, this is just one example of such a variable. There was a subset of questions where there were, I think, 14 questions that was this hospital anxiety and depression scale, where every second question, so it's this variable heads 2 and heads 4 and heads 6, for instance, tries to measure the depression variable there. So what I do here is that I just sum up this. So I make a sum score where I just add these together and then make a new score that's called heads depression. And that's now my new one of my new dependent variables. So this is a normal way to handle data. You try to make more elaborated data from categorical data. So instead now of having a score that consists of 4 numbers, so there are 4, you can score 0, 2, 3 in the questionnaire on each of these questions, where of course 0 means no depression and 3 means a lot. But over these 6 questions, you can then get a score that's somewhere between 0 and 6 times 3, 18. So you get a lot more variability and a better measurement of the phenomena that we want to measure. Okay. Like that. When we have done this, you can see that in the end here, I get a number of new variables. So we have this these now as individual variables. Now, a good starting point is, of course, to try to describe our data set. Try to look at it. How are the distribution of these variables? And one way to do this is to do some kind of a... I think we need to go there. I'll just do some kind of a frequency distribution here and look at different at some variable. Now maybe it's a good idea to look at the, for instance, the number of nights you did, and I want to look at the different other variables here. I would like to see some statistics. I would like to see the mean scores, the median scores, the modal scores. The most common score may be important for some of these values. Probably not, but I usually do this. And I want to look at the, in this case, the standard deviation, for instance. There is a number of other variables I could look at as well. Something we tend to use now and then is to look at the skewness of the distribution, for instance. Does it seem to be very different from an expected normal distribution? Because that's an assumption we do when we do some of the statistics here. So let's do that, and maybe we can do some charting as well, and histogram with a normal distribution over it. Which gives us something like this. We can look at this table first. You can see that we have 809 valid observations here. So there is a lot of questionnaires that have been handed out here. I think actually it's real data from some sleep research institute in Bergen. So, but these data are new to me as well. Just got them yesterday, so this is somewhat a live data analysis we're doing here now. We can see that this is, for instance, something that's kind of interesting. You can see here that when it comes to the number of nights that has been that people have been working here, there is quite a discrepancy. Here, the value that divides the population in two is 15 nights. The mean score is 22, meaning that some people probably are way up on the scale here. We will often find the same thing with age, for instance. And it gives us some indication of how we can treat data. Maybe it's a good idea to take out some of the extremes here. But of course, in this case, it's a natural thing. A lot of people do many night shifts, and a lot of people have none. So I guess most of the population we have here, I'm not sure of that yet. Yeah, well, we can see it here. So 200 of these nurses have not worked night shifts during the last year, while there is quite a high tail up in the high end here. So we can see that afterwards as well. For the other scores, there is not so much variance. These two scales here seems to have some kind of a strange effect, whereas a lot of people typically scores low here, while some scores quite high. We can probably see that as well when we look at the tables down here, or the plots. So, for instance, when we see this plot here, it's so lagging when I scroll here. The you can see here that you can see this deviance here. So, it's probably a good idea in this case to do some treatment of these data. Maybe put them into subgroups or something like that. Maybe compare those who do not go any night shifts at all to those that do night shifts or something like that, or decide on some kind of a cutoff point somewhere on that scale. That's probably what we will be after here. I think what causes the lag is maybe this one. So, back here. When it comes to some of the other variables, this is an extremely nice distribution, normal distribution of this phenomena, as you can see. And these are real data, and phenomena like this tend to have this these characteristics. They tend to be normally distributed. It's the most common value is in the middle there. And it's very well distributed to the ends. Of course, there are limitations of how high scores can be here. And so goes for the other things here. Although you can see, for instance, on this one, the normal score is kind of lower than the there are a tail upwards on some of these scales, especially so for the anxiety and depression scales, where you can see you have a what we usually call a roof or a floor effect in this case, where you can't of course have a lower score than zero, and a lot of people scores down there, but you also have a very long tail upwards. So that's also an example where you would probably would like to have some kind of a cutoff point. Okay. So what we want to do now is to check whether there are some regularities in this data set, and we have some hypotheses that we want to test out. Let's try one that where we do a chi-square, for instance, across tabulation. In that case, we need categorical data, nominal data. And let's say we have a hypothesis then that those who go night duty are more inclined to be smokers than those who don't do night duties. I'm not sure why we should have that hypothesis, but at least those are numbers that we can put categories into. So what I have done then is that I have also made a new variable here that's called night shifts, and that has the values 1 and or 0 and 1 instead of the number of nights you have had. And these values I then can put into a spreadsheet and do calculations based on. So I've not done this before on these data, but let me just try it. I think it's cross tabs. I want to check whether there is a relationship between night shifts, whether you have or have not gone done night shifts, and whether they are smokers or not, for instance. So this is what I want to test now. Do these fall into groups in a very skewed way, or is it just random whether smokers come into the night shift group or not? So I want to like this, and I want to do some statistics. I want to calculate this chi-square. There's a lot of choices here, so I don't expect you to remember what I do here now. But you will practice with the same software when we are doing this research project. So I did this, and I also want to get some more numbers in the based on the table that I make here. So like that, I think. It should give me some. So now we have a 2x2 table. Daily smokers, non-smokers. So you can see that in the group that doesn't do night shifts, we have 24 smokers and 214 non-smokers. In the group that does night shifts, we have 48 that are smokers and 500 that are non-smokers. Of course, there are much more people in this group. So what I expect that we see here is that there is no relationship between these variables. So our research hypothesis that there were such a relationship cannot be confirmed. Meaning that we keep our null hypothesis. I can explain these numbers later when it's a bit closer to being what we call statistically significant. So this was just an example of a chi-square test where you test nominal data in a 2x2 table. But we could do some more interesting stuff here. We could let's check if there is some kind of a relationship between doing night shifts and your level of depression let's do the sleep measurements first. Let's do the daytime sleepiness thing. Are you more likely to be sleepy during daytime if you have done night shifts compared to when you haven't done night shifts? Maybe and our hypothesis is then that yes, there is such a relationship. Don't you think? If you are doing night shifts, it's more likely that you are sleepy during daytime. And that's the variable that we call ESS, I think. That's the sleepiness scale. So what I do then is to do... I have one... Of course, it's probably not a very good variable because I did the cutoff point of one here. So if you have done one night shift during the last year, well, you fall into the category of night workers here now. So it's maybe a bit too simplified. Maybe the cutoff point should be somewhere else. Maybe it should be more than 10 or something like that. We could try that as well. It's very easy to do. But you know, since I have made this variable, let me use that one. And what I do then is to enter that variable into what's called this independent samples t-test, where I want to check the difference between two populations, or check whether it's one or two populations. So I played a little around with this data earlier here, so I have some idea what to expect. It's not absolutely live data analysis. It's a little bit of cheating. I have a grouping variable here, an independent variable that's called night duty or nattevakter in this case, where I want to check the difference between the two of these groups with the values I think 0. Why didn't I see that? That's strange. 0 and 1. Let's see what happens. Whoa. There it is. Strange things happen in programs like this. So the groups... No, that's wrong. That's the groups... I think I used the values 0 and 1. Meaning that I need to do this and this like that, and I want to test whether this one varies depending on this variable. So when I do that, I get something like this. I can see that I have 238 people in the no category and 570 in the other category here. There is a slightly difference in the scores of these two groups, as you can see from here. The mean score for the non-night duty group is 8.5. And the night duty group has a score of 9.2. So there are seem to be, at least in the mean score, slightly more sleepy. I can also see the standard deviation here, which of course is a lot larger than the difference here, so these groups are overlapping quite a bit. But when we calculate this, we get these numbers down here, where I can see, and this is, for instance, one of the numbers that I look at, the significance level. And in order to say that something, in order to throw away the null hypothesis, it must be more than, let's say, 5 or 1% certain that this, the difference between the groups we have here is not due to chance. And that's what we see in this significance number here. It gives us the number of 0.17, and translated into other words, it's not exact, but we could say that this tells us that there is a point, or if we round this up, there's a 2% chance that this is due to chance. So it's highly unlikely. There is a 98% chance that these actually are two different populations. So in this case, if at least if we say that if we use a 5% significance level, we can keep our research hypothesis. There is a relationship between going night shifts and being sleepy during daytime. If this number was above 0.05, if it was 0.06 or 0.051, then we would have to keep the null hypothesis. So that's, of course, in this case, when we keep the null hypothesis, there is a chance that we have committed a type 1 error. And in order to decrease the chance of doing a type 1 error, that's keeping our research hypothesis, well, we can increase the significance level here. We can make it harder to meet the criteria that we are setting. And a harder criteria here could be a 1% level, for instance. And we have not reached that level here. We are above that level. So if we choose to be very conservative and do this on a 1% significance level, well, then we would have to keep our null hypothesis in this case. We could do the... I can do this to see if it's clearer if you did another cutoff point here. So I can do the same test, but having done one night shift is enough, I can be more critical here and say that it's only those who have more than 10 night shifts, for instance, that's going to be used here. So I can use that as cutoff point and see how that changes things. Hopefully things will become clearer then. No, there was some kind of difficulty. Oh yeah, this night shift, I should use the other variable. Like that, and instead of this variable I should use the basic variable here. How many night shifts have you done? And then use the cut point, which is probably there already, 10. So it's but actually it was not that clear, because the difference between the groups actually decreased there, so it gives some indication that this measurement of daytime sleepiness is not probably not a very good measurement of it's not a very predictable effect of doing night shifts. But we can do the same thing on let's do the same on a number of variables. So we can just, and this is something we often do early on, we have a lot of hypotheses. We say that we can have a number of hypotheses. We can say that those who do many night shifts, well, they will, it's more likely that they are insomniac, for instance. It's more likely that they are depressed and have high levels of anxiety. So we have many of these hypotheses. So we can do a few more of them. So if I do this on not only this one, but let's try to introduce more of the variables. With a cutoff point of 10 nights. And when I see that, there is only one, actually, variable when I do this 10 cutoff point that seems to vary with whether you are doing a lot of night shifts or not, and that is how much alcohol you drink. And actually, in this case, the more night shifts, the more likely you are to drink. So, so just examples of what you can do with data. There is, of course, what I do now is a very simplified thing where I have two groups that are similar. In a more realistic setting, I would probably handle this as continuous data, and I would compare them. I would do regression analysis where I look at the relationship between variables. I would do analysis of variance in this case. I would try to do this at several levels as well. I want to look at the individual, for instance, contributions from other variables. Because it may be so that actually being a smoker is more have more explanatory effect than doing night shifts here on, for instance, anxiety and these measures. So when I do the cutoff point of one, whether you have gone night shifts or not, you get a lot clearer results here. You get a lot of significant connections. So what are the true values? I don't know. So these are only examples of what you can do. If you have any ideas of what to investigate in this data set, anyone? We can try it. It's possible. We know how much they smoke, we know how much they drink, we know how much they sleep, and if they are sleeping, we know their anxiety levels, we know their age, we know their gender. That's a touchy theme, so I'm not sure I'm going to do that. We know their um, what other variables do we have knowledge about here? We know whether they have children at home, for instance. Any ideas? Huh? Alcohol and depression. Okay. Alcohol consumption and the level of depression. Okay. Analyze. I'd probably do a regression analysis because these variables are they're not continuous, so maybe I'll do it one-way analysis of variance. So we have as a dependent variable, we put in this score of alcohol consumption. I think it's actually questions that has not necessarily to do with level of consumption, but problems with alcohol. I'm not sure about the questions here. Put it the depression scale, which is, so we could take depression and anxiety. We can have both of these in here. Let's do it the other way. So we want to see whether alcohol consumption predicts anxiety and depression. Agree? So let's say we'll see what we get there. And these values are then, as you can see here, we calculate an F value. And that is then we look in a table with that F value based on the number of observations we have here, and we don't meet the criteria for statistically significant results when it comes to anxiety, but interesting enough, we just reach the 5% criteria when it comes to depression. So there is a positive relationship here between alcohol consumption and depression in this data set at the 5% level. We just meet the 5% criteria here. We are just below this criteria. We don't reach the 1% criteria. So this is how we read this data. Degrees of freedom here is the number of groups we have, minus one. We probably have 12 groups here. Within groups, we have some 800 observations, 798. So that's what we can do. Any other suggestions? Feel free. In case you don't have, well, then we say it's what we expect to do today. I have spoken to some other groups about your trial experiment that you're going to do in this course. I would like you to, those I haven't spoken to, please make an appointment with me so we can talk about your project. I can help you narrow things down if you have no ideas about what to do. And I will tell you what I expect of you. So, but basically what you're going to do is that you're going to structure data in a similar format to what we saw here. One line per subject, one column per variable. And these variables should be of different qualities. Some of them should be nominal, preferably. Some should preferably be scale data, or could be made into scale data as we did here. Yes. Good. Thanks.